Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the show this week, we continue our series of conversations with leaders from the Defense Health Agency. These interviews are coinciding with the period in time when DHA is gearing up to declare full operational capability. They've been on that glide path for the last 2 years, first declaring initial operating capability back in 2013. Our guest this week is Brigadier General Robert Miller, the Director of the Training and Education Directorate at DHA, one of six directorates that make up the agency. He's also the Commandant of the Medical Education and Training Campus at Joint Base San Antonio. He talked with me by phone from his office there about both METC and the new Training and Education Directorate and what it's accomplished in the short time it's been up and running so far.
The Education and Training Directorate of the Defense Health Agency is the last of six directorates to stand up. So with DHA having been around since 2013, we stood up in August of 2014. So we're just a little bit over a year old and are primarily down in San Antonio. So we're all things education and training. The headquarters group is a smaller group of folks, about eight, that are up there in Falls Church at the Defense Health Headquarters between three divisions. And they're supporting a working group and the primary crux of what is education and training is down here in San Antonio at Fort Sam Houston, and the big piece is METSE, the Medical Education and Training Campus, where essentially we do all enlisted medical training for all services in 49 different career fields. We also have two other entities down here that previously were aligned under the Army and have moved under DHA. One is called DMRTI, the Defense Medical Readiness Training Institute, that does readiness training for officer and enlisted, and there's another important organization called JMEC, the Joint Medical Executive Skills Institute, that it's kind of involved with executive leadership training, and so that's kind of the major players. Like I said, a lot in San Antonio, headquarters up at Falls Church, and as far as the directorate itself, we were tasked with 12 kind of key deliverables initiatives by the services that we are working on. And as you can imagine, when they stood up education and training, I mean, there's a lot of things that could fall under that umbrella.
Sure.
So we kind of had to prioritize based on those service requirements and start tackling some of those key initiatives.
So talk a bit about the process you used as you decided what to tackle first. How did you settle on those 12 and decide that these actually make sense to provide as a shared service?
Sure. There was a working group stood up that involved representatives from all services, in addition to health affairs and other key parties like the Uniformed Services University. And so, you know, we exist as a defense health agency to support the services. So they had a lot of say into what we should be focusing on initially, as did, Dr. Woodson, the leader of the Defense Health Agency, health affairs, and others. So initially when we started off with that 12, then it was a matter of kind of prioritizing, because as you can imagine, you're not going to get them all done overnight, and some had a higher priority than others. But, for example, I mean, right off the bat, as I mentioned, having those three major organizations down here in San Antonio, METSE, DMRTI, and JMEC, each one of those were initiatives to kind of realign them under the DHA. And so all these things are equally important major undertakings, but are kind of in different stages of development.
And you mentioned the three organizations in San Antonio. Say a bit more, if you can, about where this new directorate sits in relation to the broader DOD medical education superstructure, in relation to things like the Uniformed Services University for the Health Science and those three San Antonio organizations you mentioned. What's the structure like?
So With the stand-up of the Education and Training Directorate, I'm actually dual-hatted. I'm kind of in a unique position. So I am, as the Director of Education and Training, I report up to Lieutenant General Rob, who is the Director overall of DHA. And my second hat is I'm also the Commandant of the Medical Education and Training Campus down here in San Antonio, which in and of itself is relatively new. It stood up in 2010, so only 5 years old. And just of note, I mean, it previously the services were training on in their own locations, and Brack Law in 2005 directed that the services come together and co-locate, and they happened to pick Fort Sam Houston down here in San Antonio, which is where the Army was always training. The Air Force came down from Shepherd, and the Navy was actually in three different locations and joined us here. So it is, when you think of Uniformed Services University, which is not a part of Education and Training Directorate, but we're, as USU is for officer training for physicians, which, you know, by the way, happens to be my alma mater, is where I trained as a physician in the Air Force. We are similar to that from an enlisted medical training standpoint. And as far as the other organizations, as I mentioned, you know, there were pieces down here in San Antonio that previously were under the Army and the AMED Center and School, and now are aligned under Education and Training Directorate. So there's just a lot of opportunities with the stand-up of the Directorate all under General Rob, where now we can consolidate resources. We have an ability to leverage what we do in a little better way. It's still the services that are defining the requirements, and we, in that combat support agency role, are meeting those requirements. But it does give us a lot of unique opportunities to do things better, smarter. And at the end of the day, when you're talking about education and training, it is about, you know, quality education and training. And then when we can save money on top of that, that's a good thing too.
And this is going to sound like an obvious question, but talk a little bit, if you could, about why it makes sense to provide these training and education activities as a shared service, vice having the services run them on their own.
And it is critical, because there are just so many opportunities where there was, at times, there's overlap, and when we can consolidate how we train, then you kind of get the best of all the services. Now, there are times, I have to admit, where the mission, even at METC, when you think of our enlisted training campus, the mission dictates that some of our training programs still need to be sustained as a service-specific training. But there are just many opportunities. I mean, of our 49 programs today, you know, we have consolidated at 37 of those, and to one degree or another, and always looking for those opportunities, because there's no reason to do things separately. I mean, we, as we like to say, we train as we fight, and we are part of a joint DOD. So starting folks off, to be honest, right from day one in a joint environment where they're seeing folks of other uniforms and understanding how different services do things. I mean, medicine is kind of that great equalizer. We're true, we each have our own unique cultures and identities, and we're able to preserve that history, the core values that make each service special. But in the same regard, getting back to that medicine being the great equalizer, you know, saving someone's life or responding when someone's wounded, ill, or injured, there's not a lot of differences there. And so trying to maximize those training opportunities is a very good thing. I experienced it myself at USU, and getting to see it happen day in and day out for our students here at METC. I mean, we're talking about on any given day, 6,000 plus young folks marching around this campus with 20,000 plus graduates a year. It's a pretty cool place.
Brigadier General Robert Miller is the director of the Defense Health Agency's Training and Education Directorate. We'll talk more about that place, the Medical Education and Training Campus, and DHA's shared service approach to training and education when we come back from a quick break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servio. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Servio. Getting back to our conversation with Brigadier General Robert Miller, the director of the Defense Health Agency's Training and Education Directorate. As we heard before the break, he's also the commandant of the Medical Education and Training Campus at Joint Base San Antonio. Much like the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences is the primary training center for officers in the military medical system, METC has become the central education facility for enlisted medical personnel. And you mentioned that you're kind of the analog to USU for the enlisted force. What sorts of positions are you training for? I mean, for people who aren't familiar with the DoD medical community, what are these jobs and what kinds of training are you delivering to them?
Yeah, so it is a fairly complex campus where we offer 49 different programs of instruction in 30 different disciplines. So You could pretty much name it, anything from a surgical tech to a dental tech to a radiology tech to a combat medic, across the board. Once again, Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Marines. If they are an enlisted medic, they're coming through here now since 2010. And it's also important to point out that, you know, each one of these programs are a little bit different. So the length will vary from the shortest are a couple months. And the longest can be up to a year. That being said, you know, we got new students coming in on a weekly basis, so it's just almost a continuous machine, if you will. And what is really special about this place is, you know, the focus for the services has always been training for the mission, and that's been the driver and very important. But as we also, you know, take into account civilian healthcare standards, and if those standards are ever increasing. So whereas now our students may need to have certain certificates or degrees to be able to practice their specialty, we're acutely aware of that and are looking at how do we provide them with some of those important documents, because at the end of the day, what we've found in comparing our programs of instruction with civilian schools is we're already training to a lot of those civilian standards. And so the real beauty of this place is with a few courses here and there, we're working out ways so that our students not only are trained for the mission, but ideally in the future, they're going to be walking away with those certificates and degrees that they've actually already earned based on their training here at METC, but it's going to set them up when they leave the military, whenever that is, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and they become veterans and potentially still want to be a part of healthcare and go back to their hometown and be a medic, whatever their expertise is. So that's why our new motto here at METC, which I think is very appropriate, is train for the mission, educate for a lifetime. And we do that today for our officers. I mean, that's what was done for me at USU. I actually, you know, graduated and I'm a pediatrician by trade, but we haven't always done that for all the enlisted, and we can, and I think it is equally important. So a lot of emphasis going into how do we get those certificates and degrees for these folks and kind of close that gap, because they've got the great skills. They just may not always have the paperwork they need to transition into the civilian world.
Yeah, we've heard so much about civilian credentialing broadly across the department recently. How far along are you on that? I mean, I don't know if you can put it in percentage terms or whatever, but to what extent are the folks you're training getting credentials that are fully portable to private sector?
Yeah, it is interesting. So today, three of our 49 programs actually award degrees and certifications. understanding that those are, once again, it has to be service-driven. But when you look at the remaining 46 programs, 23 of them actually require at least one certification, and the other 23, the programs are eligible for at least one. So we're always looking into those opportunities. So we're kind of attacking it in twofold. One is something we call bridge programs, where as different civilian colleges and universities across the country have learned about METSI, and you know, and sometimes the way our curriculum, our classes, we may call the class a different name, but when we kind of did the crosswalk and looked at what we were actually teaching and the civilian facilities compared to their own, they realized, my goodness, we're already meeting those requirements. So what we've been able to arrange with these so-called bridge programs is, you know, a METSI graduate who maybe they finish up as a combat medic and they want to get an RN degree. Well, now they can easily go on online and figure out that there's a litany of colleges and universities. I think the growing number, we're in the 40s now in 23 states that will recognize the METSI training and will give you the credit. So you folks today can leave here as a combat medic and in half the time essentially complete their RN degree, something that should take somebody 2 years. They can get it done in a year. And then, once again, they can take that RN and turn it into a BSN in half the time, half the money, because they're finally getting the credit that they've earned for their military training, not even to consider their experience. Because what we want to prevent is, obviously, that somebody spends a career getting these great skills serving their country and then, you know, finish up after 20 years and find out, well, they got to go back to school when they return home because even though they've got the experience, they don't have the paperwork. So bridge programs are a wonderful thing, but what we are looking at to even take it a step further is, can we affiliate, METSI affiliate with an academic institution so that down the road we can potentially grant degrees here? So that would really be the end game if we can get to that point. So we're looking at a lot of different opportunities and how we get there because, once again, you know, we do it for officers. There's absolutely no reason we shouldn't support our enlisted medics in the same way. And that motto, training for the mission, educate for a lifetime, goes both ways, applies to both groups of folks.
Just one last thing on those bridge programs. I mean, how much of that required METSI to actually modify your curriculum so that it was more in line with what the civilian world expects? And how much did the civilian you know, colleges and universities who are operating the educational programs on the outside have to change to create these bridges, if that question makes sense?
It does. And actually, it required almost no change in the curriculums. It really was an awareness issue, and you know, this is once again kind of the beauty of the DHA, because you know, when a METSI was brought together and we brought all the different services together for training, we started looking at degrees and the such, to be honest, a little more with a focus on the instructors based upon some requirements we had of what the instructors were required to have. But in so doing, that's where it kind of came to light that, oh my goodness, you know, when you compare the services across the board, some of our programs are already meeting those standards. So it was just a matter of starting off with a couple schools, which we did here in San Antonio. I think Alamo College was one of the first ones that, as we were looking at the nursing programs and our combat medics coming out of here and comparing curriculums, saying, you know what, if we just ignore the name of the course, but we just compare curriculums, we're already there. I mean, you throw in maybe a what we call general education courses, a math and English, kind of some of the basic prep courses. There's not that much difference in the requirements. So it really has grown from there, and that's why it's amazing how we'll get different civilian colleges and universities that haven't heard much about METSI, don't really realize that today This place is the largest producer of accredited allied health professionals in the world. And when they realize that we're already training to the civilian standards, that there's very little change required, it's just a matter of giving our students the credit for what they've already earned so that they're not, you know, starting from ground zero when they finish their military career.
Brigadier General Robert Miller is the director of the Defense Health Agency's Training and Education Directorate. He'll join us for one more segment after a quick break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Thanks for listening to federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. One more segment this week with Brigadier General Robert Miller. He is the director of the Defense Health Agency's Training and Education Directorate. He joined us to talk about that new directorate, one of six that make up DHA as that organization prepares to declare full operating capability on October 1st. So as you said toward the beginning of our conversation, your new directorate's only about a year old. In that short time, what would you say are the accomplishments you're most proud of?
There's a few that I'd like to highlight. I guess one of the biggies involves learning management system transition. You know, as you can imagine, there's tons of online learning sites. Each service kind of had their own way of having different sites that you would have to go to, whether you're a doc, a nurse, a dentist, a technician, to maintain your training. You know, a common one is something we call HIPAA, the Privacy Act training. And so the goal was, can we consolidate all those different sites so that our users don't have to worry about going to 10 different locations? Can they all be brought into one? And so that has been one of the key 12 initiatives. And to date, we've moved three of those online sites into one. They're all moving to something called Joint Knowledge Online, JKO. And that's been more successful than we had dreamed. There's a pretty large online training site called Military Health Systems, MHS Learn, that has now retired, and everything has been moved in. So once again, it gave us the chance that, hey, if something was being offered a couple different ways in different sites, well, now you only have to pay for it one time as opposed to multiple times, and the savings even from this effort, realizing we're only done with 3 of 11, has already well exceeded our expectations. Because at the end of the day, it still is about quality training. But like I said, it's a good thing when we can save money too. And I think similar opportunities are out there. Another biggie that is very exciting is you know, in the world of mod and sim, medical modeling and simulation, where, you know, we use mannequins to help and different types of computerized tools to train our medics. We're kind of getting away from live animal models. This is another area that we're just starting to get involved with as far as the ENT directorate. The services have been doing it on their own for some time and doing great things. But once again, we've never consolidated those efforts and the leveraging power. I mean, if you have to buy a bunch of mannequins to do certain medical training, well, you know, if instead of doing it for one service, if you're bringing all the services together and you got the smart folks agreeing on a particular model that's going to work for all, you know, there's a lot of opportunities there, not only to ensure we're doing the best training, quality training, but to save money. So I think that there's a lot of exciting initiatives like that that we're just starting to get involved with over our first year here at the Education and Training Directorate.
On modeling and simulation, this is probably kind of hard to describe on the radio, but what does that actually look like when you're replacing a mannequin or a live animal with modeling and simulation? Is it all just happening on a video screen with a mouse and keyboard? How does it actually work?
No, it's kind of, think about being at Disney World almost, and where you're where you're in a room with a mannequin that's talking and moving and eyes are blinking. And in our case, it's not a ride, but it's a medical training tool where your patient now, as opposed to just pretending you're listening to breath sounds or pretending that you're feeling a pulse, it's actually there. And there is someone behind the scenes on a computer who has a standardized controlled protocol that they're putting you through, and this way we can reproduce the quality training over and over again. We know we're doing it right. And not only that, but the folks that are engaged with the mannequin as opposed to just a lump of plastic on the table, well, once again, I mean, if I'm putting my stethoscope on the chest, I'm listening and I'm hearing, oh, there's no breath sounds on one side. I need to do intervention X. And so now we have the ability, and the technology is just increasing by leaps and bounds. So as an old doc myself, I mean, the only thing we had to use were you know, live animals. And not that that's bad training, but obviously there are reasons to move away from that. And we're getting to the point where there are not many areas where you can't get great training using kind of the modern sim world. And it involves everything from intubation to, you know, starting IVs to, you know, performing a resuscitation. It really, really is pretty amazing. And I think at the end of the day, our students are really benefiting from this.
My ears perked up a little bit earlier when you mentioned that you're running this new directorate with a headquarters staff of just 8 people. How do you make the most of that incredibly small staff and maybe borrow resources from the military services or other parts of DHA?
No, that's a great question. And to be honest, I had that same question when I took over the directorate. But, you know, I can say sometimes when you're lacking on quantity, it helps to have really high quality folks, and I do, and we have representatives from each of the services, both officer and enlisted, that make up the directorate. But I can tell you that what having a smaller directorate has forced us to do, you know, without any few other options, is we now partner much more closely with other directorates within the DHA. And if we're getting a product to market and bringing things together, you know, a win for one or two directorates is a win for the whole organization and DHA. And a perfect example, when I was telling you about the learning management systems, kind of that online tool, well, we were very closely partnered with the Health Information Technology Directorate. It's a beautiful thing, and thanks to their help and their manpower, and also working with the services, which is another key part of this, we need the services to be involved, supplying us with their subject matter experts for certain projects. We can work together and once again get those products to market, and that happened with the learning management systems and continues to happen. So sure, it would be nice to grow somewhat over time, and I think we will, but I also think, you know, as far as right sizing, we're doing okay, and fully expect those success stories to continue as we continue to work these different initiatives in the directorate.
And as folks know, the Defense Health Agency as a whole is just a couple of weeks away here from full operational capability. What changes for you on 1 October, if anything? Do you flip a switch and turn on some new capabilities, or does anything change?
You know, not a whole lot changes as far as the 12 deliverables. I mean, those pretty much stay the same. But what does change is, you know, we have a working group, once again, that has each service has a representative that's a part of that working group. And so as opposed to being focused on trying to get to full operational capability, now our focus changes a little bit. And it's all about sustainment and continuing to work these deliverables. So I'd say at the end of the day, you know, it's still the same folks, it's still the same end goal, but just our focus may change just a little bit, and I think there's a lot to be excited about. A lot of work to do, no doubt, and we're just beginning this journey, but a lot of reason to be excited.
And beyond what you've already taken on as a new directorate, are there obvious examples still sitting out there in the services as low-hanging fruit that look like things that aren't yet a shared service, but probably ought to be?
Well, and maybe not even just from the standpoint of shared service, but opportunities. I mean, one of the things that we are looking hard at is standing up a military medical education consortium where how do we get the smart folks, not only in the DOD, in the education and training world, but those partners out there in the civilian community, you know, the Mayos of the world, the Johns Hopkins of the world, that have partnered with the military and the DOD in the past and want to support us. How do we work together, almost creating like a university model where we're meeting together on a routine basis and learning from them as they, you know, also learn from us, and 'cause we each have ways that we do things better than the other, and so we haven't gone down that path, but that's a perfect example of some opportunities that are on the horizon, and I think will only make things better for the military health system. We feel very excited about a lot of things, but I'm very proud of METSI more than any. I mean, it is really an amazing place, and I have to say, if you're ever down in San Antonio, it's one of those things, you know, when you're a medic and you sit in a hospital or a clinic where you're dealing with patients, you don't get that experience of having, you know, hundreds and hundreds of young kids, you know, marching to the dining hall and the passion and the esprit de corps, it's pretty inspiring. So, you know, when we have that motto of training for the mission, educating for a lifetime, it's easy for people to be very passionate about that and realize that that we're doing some good things, not only for the short term, but the long term for our country. So I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
That is Brigadier General Robert Miller. He's the director of the Defense Health Agency's Training and Education Directorate and the commandant of DOD's Medical Education and Training Campus at Joint Base San Antonio. We'll change topics when we come back from our last break of the hour. Air Force Secretary Deborah Lee James with a budget update and the Air Force's new plan to speed up acquisition times with a concept called Should Schedule. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbia. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Switching our focus in the last few minutes of the show to the Air Force and that service's acquisition and budget priorities. Top officials there say they've made steady progress on bringing the costs of their major procurement programs under control. Schedule is another matter. They freely acknowledge that programs take far too long, even when they're bought via sole source contracts. So the Air Force plans to tackle schedule growth through a new concept it's calling Should Schedule, a takeoff on DoD's Should Cost strategy for reducing the prices of big systems. Secretary Deborah Lee James announced the Should Schedule concept at the annual Air and Space Conference in National Harbor, Maryland. We're going to play an excerpt from that speech in our last few minutes. In this section, she begins by saying the Air Force needs to maintain a careful balance in its spending on modernization and readiness.
You're already well aware that for over 25 years, we've been flying combat missions, and we now have the oldest fleet in our history with more responsibilities than ever before to our nation, to our joint partners, and certainly to our airmen. We're simultaneously trying to procure new aircraft while fighting relentlessly in a half dozen different places around the world, while at the same time struggling to try to recapture higher levels of readiness for a high-end fight. Now, these are very tall but very important orders, and we've got to get it done. We've got to get it done correctly, and it doesn't happen for free. So I want to once again take this opportunity to call on Congress to permanently lift sequestration. We have to send sequestration to the boneyard once and for all. We in the Air Force also need to work closely with the aerospace nation to discover and implement new and innovative ways to steward our taxpayer dollars, which of course brings me to priority number three, and that's make every dollar count. Forging a close partnership with the very industry that provides us with our capabilities is more important now than ever. We're trying to step it up when it comes to dialogue. We're trying to make our relationships even stronger because we think this will help us in the future keep our programs more on budget and more on schedule. Now, I've mentioned a couple times strategic agility. When it comes to acquisitions, as far as I'm concerned, speed should be, in the future, a fundamental metric. Will we be able to respond faster than the threat, keep up with the pace of technology, keep up with the operational innovations of our remarkable airmen? Well, if we're going to do that, we've got to speed it up. Now, we in the Air Force have made good progress in employing many of the principles of Secretary Carter's and now Secretary Kendall's better buying power. So our costs, as a general proposition, are trending downward. The number of Nunn McCurdys is down, and we're meeting our key performance parameters for our major programs at a rate above 90%, which is really good. And don't take my word for it. Take a look at the Acquisition Technology and Logistics Acquisition Performance Report, because all the statistics I just mentioned to you are in this report. But it's still not good enough. We have to continue to find new and improved ways to save taxpayer dollars. Now, we in the Air Force have tried to be very open to new ideas and innovative thinking. And in the case of acquisition, we aren't shy when it comes to experimenting with different ideas. And in a way, that's a lot of what bending the cost curve has been all about, is trying some new approaches. So today I'd like to describe a new experiment that we have in mind. To repeat, our ultimate goal in acquisitions should be to deliver capability to the warfighter more rapidly. But unfortunately, today it takes too long to develop and field our systems. Now, we had some pretty smart people under bending the cost curve take a look at why this is so. And of course, there's no single reason why this has happened. However, it did become clear to us that if we were to establish incentives to speed things up, perhaps this could advance the ball for us. So today, I'm announcing a new experiment. We're going to call it Should Schedule, in conjunction with a few potential pilot programs. I'm going to give you a few details of this, but before I do, let me first just remind you all about something called Should Cost. When a program is established by law, we must have an independent cost estimate. And when we hit key milestones along the way, we need to fully fund to that cost estimate. Now, under the should cost approach, we challenge our program offices and we challenge our industry partners to beat the independent cost estimate once the program is underway. Program offices and industry then employ a multitude of techniques to drive the cost down. After the savings are actually realized and validated, the funding is then available to us that we can pump it back into that program and portfolio. So in one recent example, we now have hundreds more air-to-air and air-to-ground weapons that have become available for today's fight because we were able to buy them back into our inventory through should-cost savings out of our weapons portfolio. In other words, we saved in those accounts and we were able to plow those savings back into buying more. So this leads me now back into the new idea, which is the should schedule concept. Whereas the previous incentive focused on cost, now we'd like to target delivery time. We asked ourselves, can we develop a structure that challenges us and our industry partners to deliver faster than the schedule determined as part of the independent cost estimate? Well, I say, you're damned right we can do this. Why can't we do it? And we will do it. If we can collectively beat the historical developmental schedules and reward the behavior in government and industry that speeds things up, we have a real chance to make a difference. So today, I'm announcing that we're examining some of our smaller programs. We're going to start small and look to go big if this works out. But some of our smaller programs are under consideration for should schedule. Things like the Bomber Armament Tester, or the Enhanced GPS INS Modernization Program, the Advanced Precision Kill Weapons System. These are all potential should schedule pilots that we are going to work on the details and see what we can do. Established programs will have an engineering, manufacturing, and development phase under this experiment based on historical data, just like they always do. But here's what will be new. We'll hold a competitive EMD where we reward and incentivize speed to ramp. In other words, if an industry partner can propose a solution that credibly offers a way to accelerate successful EMD, then that company would have a competitive advantage for the award. Now keep in mind, an accelerated EMD plan would need to survive a detailed scrub by independent engineers. And like should cost, we will only adjust to the faster schedule after it is realized and independently validated. And finally, I do want to note that we won't allow this to become a reason for us to go sole source on an item. We will structure the acquisition strategies to ensure the appropriate level of competition and to take advantage of early opportunities for technical maturation and risk reduction activities to bring multiple industry teams up to a reasonable design level. So, ladies and gentlemen, in summary, I would just say to you all that we have certainly many challenges as we look to reinvent the aerospace nation, but I see way, way, way more opportunities than challenges. We won't get this done overnight. This effort will take time, but it starts today. It starts here and now. It starts with all of your help. General Welsh and I extend an invitation to each and every one of you who has an idea about advancing aerospace to make our world better. We invite all of you to think, particularly those of you in industry, about the should schedule idea, and we invite all of you to advance the goals of strategic and operational agility, and most importantly of all, please keep taking care of our airmen.
Again, Deborah Lee James, the Secretary of the Air Force, speaking at the annual Air and Space Conference in National Harbor, Maryland, describing the Air Force's new strategy called Should Schedule to deliver programs closer to on time and talking about some of the service's budget priorities. Before that, we heard from Brigadier General Robert Miller. He's the director of the Defense Health Agency's new Training and Education Directorate and the Commandant of DOD's Medical Education and Training Campus at Joint Base San Antonio. If you missed that conversation, we'll post the full program at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. That's going to do it for the program this week. Thanks as always for tuning in to On DOD. I'm Jared Serbio. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.